For the late start, this is TechNet number 1139 with Mel and Dick and Barry and Rich and Julio, the real TechNet people. Do we have anybody that wants to check in? Give me your call letters, your name, and a confirming yes if you think you do have a question or a comment. Go right ahead right now.
Next D.
Okay, yeah. Something I've covered, NXD or something like that. Give us the whole call letters and name, sir.
Okay, it's Kilowatt Charlie 2, London X-Ray Delta, and the name is Rodney, QSL.
Okay, Rodney, and we're going to assume that you're a yes, you've got a question. Anyone else?
KC2MDT, Steve, and yes, Dick, question.
Okay, we got Steve. Anyone else?
N2MAT. My name is Nick. No questions, just check in.
Okay, Nick with a no. Anyone else?
KC2RIW in the group with a question.
Okay, Matthew says he's got a question. Matthew's already signed in, so we're going to start off with you. Matthew, you're number one on the runway. Go right ahead.
I have a question. Might sound simple to other people, but can you explain simplex a little bit?
Yeah, you're going to hear those words. To a person just getting on ham radio, and particularly getting on 2-meter FM radio, you'll hear the word simplex, you'll hear the word duplex, and you'll hear the word repeater. Most of the time, what people mean when they say the word simplex is that you're transmitting and receiving on the exact same frequency, and usually one person talking at a time. If you and I right now decided to go over to 146.52, sort of the national calling frequency on FM, and it's a so-called simplex frequency. You look it up in the repeater guide, it'll be listed as simplex. That means a person goes there and says, KC2RAW, I feel like talking, or I'm listening on 52. And then you stop transmitting, and if somebody hears you and wants to talk to you, they set their transmitter on 146.52 and talk back. So one at a time, you're all talking on the exact same frequency, that's simplex. Whereas this repeater, right now, you and I, we set the dial on our transceiver for 146.85, and somewhere else you tell the rig of yours that it's a 600 KC minus, so that the rig knows, by way of what you put into its microprocessor, that when you push the talk button, it's going to jump down from 146.85 where you were listening. It's going to jump down to 146.25, 600 KC lower, and transmit. And the repeater that's at Glen Oaks listens on 25, 146.25, demodulates that signal down to audio, applies that audio to a transmitter that's on 146.85. That's what a repeater does. Listens on one frequency, simultaneously transmits on another frequency. And the magic is that all of that takes place on the same antenna. The same antenna at the repeater site, usually, is receiving and transmitting at the same time. It takes a very fancy duplexing filter to do that. Ordinarily, your transmitter is so potent as far as the weak signals a receiver is made for, that the receiver would be overloaded like crazy without that duplexing filter. So that's duplexing filter, simultaneous transmit and receive. You will occasionally hear a rare repeater that is so-called split site. That really means that in one location it's receiving on the first antenna, and somehow between the two locations there's an audio connection or a microwave link connection, and there's a transmitter at another site. So in that case, you're receiving on one antenna and transmitting on the other. That's a so-called split site repeater. They're rare. And you can probably see the problem that they can create because you're not transmitting receiving from the same antenna. You can have slightly different patterns. In other words, the receiving site has a pattern that favors the town it's located in. The transmitter site has an antenna pattern that favors the town it's located in. And so a person, if he's unlucky, could be located in a town where the receiver site hears them very well, but he doesn't hear the transmitter site very well, or vice versa. That's the problem of split sites. So simplex operation is kind of fun. 146.52 is the national calling frequency. There's a group of guys on Long Island called the Long Island Simplex Amateur Radio Group. I don't know the exact name. I should. I'm a member. They meet on 147.575. 147.575. Always simplex. They all transmit and receive on that exact same frequency. And there's a group of about 50 guys that get together there and tell each other what they think and tell each other tall stories. And to them, that's their favorite frequency. They own it. And that's what ham radio is to them. They've carved out their little chunk of the universe, and they use it in that manner. Maybe that makes some sense, Matthew.
I just want to add one more little thing to that, Dick, that might make it a little clearer for Matthew.
Go ahead, about. Here we go, Barry.
Okay, yeah, Matthew, there's another thing. It's not always termed this way, but it is. It is really simplex. All the communications on the low bands, on 20, 40, all the sideband communications and the CW communications, that's all done, they receive and they transmit on the very same frequency. And, you know, you could really call that simplex. It's not often said that way, but that's really what it is. Go ahead, Matthew, and 2MB.
And I'm going to inject something on that one, too. Even there, there's a little bit of non-simplex that occasionally occurs with a DX station. If you travel to some very rare island and you negotiate with the equivalent of the FCC for the ownership of that island, you get a license to operate from there, and now you're creating a pilot because everybody wants this brand new country that's never been heard from before, and they want to add it to their list. The guy who's got 331 countries and a brand new country comes along, he can get 332, and he can keep claiming he's got every single country in the world. He's going to gather there real fast. Well, in order to stop a great big pileup, the guy doing the operation from the DX location, from the islands on the air or whatever it is, he will announce over the air, yeah, I'm on 14.241, but I'm listening 20 kilohertz down. I'm listening 20 kilohertz down. And that way, people can always hear him, and they're not just piling on top of his frequency. And he's listening somewhere else, and he's announcing. And so that's a slight variation of, not quite simplex. I'm not quite sure what you would call that. I'll call that a DX operation frequency split, so to speak. KC2RAW, K2RIW.
Called split operation. It's called split operation when you when you're not receiving and transmitting on the same frequency. We're using EFO.
Thank you, Howie. You got it, Matthew.
Split station box would be like let's say, like transmit on 2 meter and receive on 440.
Most people, that is a kind of a split site, but most people will call that cross banding because you really are on two different bands. So most people will call that cross banding. But yeah, it's a kind of a split site. It's a kind of a offset frequency and so on. During contests, almost all contests will not accept cross-band operation. If I'm operating on the 10 gigahertz contest, and if I'm using 2 meters as a so-called talk-back frequency, in other words, I would get on 2 meters, sideband 146.26, correction, 144.260 is one of the main frequencies used on the East Coast. I get on there on sideband with my 50-watt transmitter and my Yagi antenna, and I'm on top of the mountain. And I say, hey, this is a 10-gig operation. If anybody around has 10-gig equipment, please call me back on 146.26, where we are right now, and tell me where you're located so I can aim my 3-degree beamless dish at you. Tell me what frequency you're on. Tell me who's going to transmit first. And then the real contact itself must be a two-way contact on 10 gigs where all the information is passed back and forth on 2 gigs. So to qualify for the contest, the real operation, two-way, simplex, is on 10 gigs. But you're doing a cross-banding operation to set up the contact itself, and that's called using the talk-back frequency or the calling frequency.
You might want to comment that most amateur satellites are cross-band.
And by the way...
Yeah, that's another good point. In fact, what's the name of the mode, Barry? Is it called mode B, where you transmit up on 2 meters and listen back down on 435 megacycles? Back to you, Barry.
Yeah, that's mode B, and of course they have mode S. They have many, many modes. The most popular has been 2 meters up, 432 down. I'm using the bands rather than the frequencies. But lately, you have 432 up and 2304 down. That's becoming more popular now. But in the past, you've had anything from 10 meters up to 432 down. I mean, you know, they have every mix you can think of. They try to use as many amateur bands as they can. 1296 is a very popular uplink, and 432 down or 2304 down or both at the same time is becoming very popular now, too. I don't want to complicate this, but that's all crossband.
Well, I got a comment here, WD2HWW.
Go ahead, Howie.
Yeah, when you're saying, you know, Dick, when you're saying using 2 meters to coordinate, that's just an intercom frequency. That's not real crossbanding. Crossbanding is when you would be going from 2 to 440. You come in on 2 and go out on 440. That's what crossbanding is, when you have a radio in the car and you're using it as a remote repeat. Like you want, you're on UHF and you want to talk to, let's say, Limark, and you're in your house or you're in a building and you got your car out there. What you're doing when you're using 2 meters, I would call that a coordinating frequency, Dick.
Not necessarily. I'm going to challenge you on this one, Howie. 20% of the time, the smart operators on 10 gig will announce on the so-called talkback frequency, the calling frequency, 144.260, or up 10 or up 20, depending on how much busyness there is. They will announce the fact that they're on 10 gigs. Somebody calls them back on 10 gigs and says, where are you located? He aims the dish roughly in that direction. And then what some of the smart guys will do is they'll transmit a 10 gig signal and listen on 2 meters. The guy on the other end is transmitting on 2 meters and listening on 10 gigs, playing it back to him, playing it back in the Morse code mode, so that the guy who is aiming the 10 gig dish aims it back and forth and adjusts the frequency until he hears the loudest tone coming back to him on 2 meters. That's true crossbanding by my... So during the alignment of the dishes, they are doing true full duplex crossband. And the advantage of crossbanding, as you probably can tell, Matt, is that most rigs will allow you to transmit on one frequency, and side by side you've got another rig on another antenna listening on another frequency, and that works. You try transmitting and receiving within the same band, and the rig will not tolerate it for a bunch of technical reasons. But when they're on two different bands, they will usually tolerate it. Second to that is that satellites use crossbanding because you could transmit and receive on the same frequency on the satellite, but we require this great big duplexing filter to do it. And that's got a lot of volume and a lot of mass, and it's got a lot of sensitivity to temperature and humidity and vibration and so on. So you don't want to put a duplexing filter on a satellite. It would be almost as heavy as the whole darn satellite. So therefore, almost all satellites do cross-banding. They receive on one band and retransmit on another band. So we've probably given you a lot more information than you asked for, Matt. And if it didn't all make sense at first, not to worry. We can always explain it to you again. KC2RAW, K2RIW. You got it, Matt. I'm Dick.
I don't know where Matt went, but Dick, I agree with you. That's called full duplex crossbanding. We're using a feedback loop. That means you're listening back on the downlink. One would be the uplink, and in the 2 meters you consider the downlink so you can hear what you're doing. That I would agree with you. I apologize. Sorry.
Go ahead, Matt. You got it. Howie. Matt, your turn to translate if you want to.
I'm sorry. I fell asleep for a minute.
We gave you so much information, we put it asleep. That's okay, Matt. Okay, the first person who signed in was Rodney, KC2 Lima X-ray Delta. Rodney, you've got the floor.
Okay, good evening, gentlemen. Thank you, Dick. My question is, I want to be able to transmit on 29.2620, and I'm not sure what the input or the PL tone would be. And also, I would like to know if the repeater has the capabilities of enabling me to transmit on that frequency, over.
Let me handle that, Dick. I know that repeater system.
Very good. And the repeater guide will probably tell you, but go ahead, Howie.
All right. That 29620, and you're going to transmit on 29520. That's 620 out, 29520 in. On 10 meters, use 100 kilohertz offset. And that would be KQ2H, and he's running an 82.5 PL. No, 146.2 PL in New Jersey, and no PL if you're trying to go into Ellenville. That's a multi-system. All repeaters on 10 meters are 100 KCs. That means 29620, 29520, 29640, 29540. My repeater on 10 meters is 29660, 29560. N2ROW is 29680, 29580. There are two simplex channels, one at either end of the thing, 29.5 and 29.6 are the two simplex frequencies. Over to you, Dick.
Fantastic. For what period of time have 10 meter repeaters been, I'm trying to think of a good word for it, popular is one word. I mean, 10 years ago, I think there were almost no 10-meter repeaters in the metropolitan New York area. Now there's a significant number of them. When did they really catch on, Howie? Because I can tell that you've been there for a long time. Looks like your repeater is probably one of the very major ones in the New York City area. WB2HWW, B2LIW.
I have been here a long time, Dick. I just put mine up in September of 2006. KQ2H had been on the air for several years. He was on for about, going back into the mid-90s. Now, what was very popular is the 29660 that used to come out of the Virgin Islands. It used to be a major machine. Now, what was interesting about that is back in the 80s, everybody would have remote bases. What I did back in the 80s and the 90s is I would run a remote base and just link up to the repeater in the Virgin Islands and hear people from all over the country. But the reason why it's coming popular, I think people are getting ready for the sunspot cycle. That's why I put mine up, because I know the sunspot cycle is coming. And I did order that filter, by the way, Dick. I sent one of the guys, actually Rich at 2EO, was very gracious enough to donate and bought us a filter. So we're going to put that filter on and see if that helps. But 10 meters is getting very popular right now with FM. And you know what? If you run 80 watts or 100 watts in the car and you got a good antenna system, you can travel 80, 90 miles. You get some good range out of good repeater system.
Yeah, there's another whole repeater scheme that when Barry and I and Howie and Matt were mentioning repeater techniques, simplex and duplex, remote base is another whole idea that first caught on very well in California. If I was living in California in the bottom of a valley somewhere where because of the local restrictions, I can't put up a tower. They wouldn't allow me to put even an antenna on the roof of the house. Either my television reception has to be by way of cable TV. And if you live in an environment like that, I mean, other than operating your handy talkie by sitting on the roof or operating from the attic, you've got very little ham radio operation of great interest. But some of those guys did. But to buy a small chunk of the local mountaintop or make a deal with somebody who's got a house or a building or whatever on top of the mountain and put a complete transmitter, receiver, antenna system on top of the mountain. And then since the guys in California were very progressive with computer control, they would say, for instance, that the mountaintop operation might be an HF rig that operates on 80 to 10 meters and might even have a rotatable antenna up there. And then by talking to the mountaintop operation, on, say, for instance, 220 or 432 or 1296. You talk to it on that frequency with your handy talkie, and you press the right combination of tones. You are selecting the band that you're using from the mountaintop. You're selecting the frequency. You're aiming the antenna. and then you sit down there in your valley bottom QTH, and with your handy talkie, you have all of the advantage of being on top of the mountain, but you're not really there. You're in the valley, and so that remote based system can be very effective and a lot of fun. And you have your buddies join you when it comes to financing it, erecting it, keeping it operational, and so on. And you might even announce it as an open system where anybody can use it as long as they obey the rules. And so that can be a lot of fun. I think it first caught on in California. I suspect there were very few of them on the East Coast. But I bet you some of you guys on the East Coast can tell me differently. How many remote-based systems are in operation on the East Coast if you know about them? Give me a call at us right now. KQRIW and the Tech Man.
Dick, I can tell you a little bit. I've been doing remote bases since the 1989-1990. Without getting into, you know, I could say, money-wise, with all the commercial antennas, the hardline, I probably put about $30,000 into the system. I have the 850 controller. I have everything from 10 meters right up through 1.2 gig on FM. I would like to one day put up a single sideband HF remote. The only other guy that has an HF remote is Jack Herrick, KF2GB. Kilowatt 2, Golf 6, KF2GB. You know who else had a remote base before he lost his one of his sites? You spoke to him a couple of times on the TechNet. It's Joe, W-A-2-R-Y-Y. He ran a full HF remote. But I like to do that one of these days. But you know what? It takes money, Dick.
Yeah, there is the equivalent of a remote base in operation out in the Hamptons. There's a ham out there in the Hamptons who can drive around in his automobile. I think he's talking to the system at his home on 220, but I'm not sure. Could be 1296. And from his home QTH, it's a 2-meter transmitter that transmits what he says from his automobile on, say, 220. And then whatever is received on 2 meters is relayed back to his automobile. So he can be driving around town and have the range and power output of his home location, because he's literally talking through his home while driving. That's a kind of remote base. So with the right kind of control networks, computer setups, and so on, and there's no end to the ways you can use RF and computers and marry them together. So maybe that's some of the information you were looking for, Rodney. I know we got a little off subject. KC2LXD, KQRIW in the TechNet.
Okay, thank you, Howie, for reflecting on that. I'm just trying to understand that, actually. So this would be considered a split frequency operation. Is that correct, Howie?
Consider the same thing as a repeating, yes. On 10 meters, we use 100 KCs offset. On 6 meters, we use 1 meg or 500. And obviously on 2 meters, we use 600 kilohertz, yes. One thing about 10-meter repeaters, they are split site. So if you try to pick up on the transmit, that doesn't necessarily mean you're going to get into the receiver that well. A lot of split site 10-meter repeaters are maybe 15 or 20 miles, just for the fact that we can't get duplexes that big. And so what we usually do is run a UHF link, you know, from the receiver to the transmitter. What I do is I basically have a receiver at one site, get into the UHF system, and then link back over. What we're running to our system is a 440 at 10 meters. Whatever it said on 440 comes out on 10. Whatever it said on 10 comes out on 440. So we're running a complete system. If anybody wants to see what it looks like and see the antennas and see all the components and see, you know, the layout of it, just go to the website, mycallers.com, hww.com, and you go there. Any other questions I can say on 10 meters?
Okay, no. Thank you. You basically answered the question. I have the Kenwood TS2000, so I just have to try to input everything and see what happens.
Yeah, if you want to wait on, you go over to my system. It's 2966 is where you listen. Transmit 29560 and generate a 114.8 PL. And that's it. I would say it's becoming very popular, Dick. All the channels, every channel in New York is being occupied right now. You know, we got M2ROW, we got M2ACF, we got KQ2H. We got some really good stuff. A lot of guys are trying to get ready. I've been breaking my hump with a lot of help from a lot of other guys just to get everything ready and working so that we can have a reliable system going into the next cycle. If they are correct, Dick, they're saying this cycle is going to be as good as 1959. Well, I don't remember 59. I was just 4 years old. If it were as good as the 69-70 cycle, I'll be happy. Over to you, Dick.
Yeah, I lived through that 58 cycle, and it was a whopper. I think it was a 100-year event, so to speak, as far as the strength of the sunspots that particular cycle. Particularly the guys who were on 6 meters, boy, they really cleaned up. The band seemed to be open very, very frequently. Okay, it's something to look forward to. One last question, Howie, on the subject. Because of local PL tones, I guess it's not going to be too much of a problem, but when the sunspot cycle really gets rolling and 10 meters is open every other day, and you're going to be hearing 10-meter signals coming in from Chicago and Texas and Oklahoma, because these repeater frequencies are all clearly defined and channelized, there's going to be a little bit of co-channel interference going on. The individual PL tones will partially control it, but how popular are the 10-meter repeaters in other major portions of the country? Back to you, Howie.
Well, two things. Number one, you have to live with the interference. My frequency on 6-6, there's about a dozen repeaters. We got a couple in Texas, got one or two in Florida. They're all over the place. You go down there, I mean, you get on the frequency, and I've been told by people you can hear heterodynes, multiple heterodynes when a band opens. And what's funny is you'll be working one repeater in, you know, they'll be hearing New York, and the next week they're hearing Florida. It moves around. It's kind of interesting. Some guys are running PL. That can help, but you just have to put up with it. It's just that's the way it is. I will also tell you that one of the things I've been doing lately is I've been bringing up the 6-meter remote bay 52525, and what they're directing is let's say somebody is on 10 meters, I would ask them to switch over to 6s to see what the conditions are. Sometimes 6s got better characteristics than 10. Hopefully, if I can get the money together, I want to put up a 6-meter repeater also, tie it in. I'm amazed. I'm in love with the 10 and 6-meter FM. One of the other things I like to do, Dick, I don't know if this is possible, I like to put up a sideband repeater on 10 meters, because I tell you one thing, FM is good, but when it starts to get into the noise, it doesn't track as well. It would be interesting to put up a complete single sideband terrestrial repeater, not a space, not in the space, but a ground repeater, Dick. Go ahead.
Tonight at 8 o'clock.
There's no doubt in my mind, Howie, that you can create a sideband repeater on 10 meters, 6 meters, or any other band. Obvious by the fact that it's already been done with satellites. However, it's going to be a translator, the IF translator. In other words, a single sideband signal coming in on, say, a 10-meter frequency, boiled down to a common IF frequency, like 10.7 megacycles, and a bandpass filter of, let's say, 30 kc or so will be employed. Amplification will take place, and then that whole band of frequencies will be retransmitted. That way, multiple signals can come through the repeater simultaneously, and you don't have to worry about them being on the exact right frequency, because a band of frequencies are being repeated. That's the way the satellites do it, and that's the way I recommend you do it. If you try to demodulate down to a audio signal and single sideband, and then reproduce the audio into the transmitter. The disadvantage of that is that any frequency error would come out as a incorrect audio tone, so to speak. In other words, you can easily have a guy sound like a girl or a girl sound like a guy when you have a single sideband frequency that where the receiver is off-tune from the transmitter. So by making this slightly broadband translator, like the satellites have used, I think you get around that problem very nicely. Now, the slight problem of, yes, You have the ability to repeat multiple signals simultaneously. Each guy can be offset by 5 or 10 kc across the 30 kc bandwidth in my example. But then if any one guy is super strong, he overtakes the channel, so to speak, and everyone else gets suppressed, because every system has got a limit in the power output that it can then transmit. The nice thing about sideband over FM is it's got at least a 10 decibel improvement in signal-to-noise ratio. At least a 10 dB weaker signal will get through and be acceptable sounding audio. You can even take the technique one step further and use the Joe Taylor technique, which are modulated Morse code tones coming through this broadband system. And therefore an extremely weak signal can be getting through and can be copied. So I think you could have a grand old time with that. As I see it, Howie, I think you should go for it.
Jake, I'm going to take you to task on one of your comments here.
Go ahead. Sounds like Barry. And Barry's used a lot of these broadband satellite repeaters. So what happens if I didn't quite cover Barry? Go ahead.
Okay, yeah. I would say he's better off if he does something like slightly broadband. In other words, able to receive, say, 2 or 3 signals at one time, and then move them to another frequency on the band and output them. Why do I say that? Because your last comment that said that if the receiver was a little off frequency, you're still going to have that problem. If the guy who's transmitting to you is not right on your receiver, your sideband receiver, it's going to be Mickey Mouse, so you can't change that. But the guy on the other end can actually correct that a little bit. So regardless of whether you're going through an IF or not, you're still going to have that.
There's a yes and a no to that one, Barry. If you're repeating an IF band of frequency, that's what the satellites have done, multiple access satellites, there is no such thing as frequency error. As long as your sideband signal is getting through the passband, the guy on the receiving end, where he's listening to the translated frequency, I'll give an example. Let's assume now that I'm transmitting uplink at 145.2 region and 100 kc of bandwidth. And I'm sending a sideband signal there. And the downlink is 435 megacycles region. And all I've got to do with my 435 receiver is tune it up and down until the audio sounds correctly. So with IF bandpass repeating, broadband multiple access repeating, the correction is automatic. If you have a single signal type repeater on single sideband where you demodulate down to audio and then take the audio into the microphone of a transmitter and then transmit a sideband signal, the amount of correction you can apply is very, very small, particularly if the guy is using, say, a 2 kc bandpass audio filter, IF filter. If you were 500 hertz off, an awful lot of the valuable portion of your audio is not going to come through no matter what you do to try to retune it. Yes, you could use the filters that you and I traded back and forth at a 3 or 4 kc wide on sideband, which is the right way to do it in my opinion. Remember the day that you and I at 2 o'clock in the morning climbed your tower and I was over there to pick up a filter for my... what was the name of that rig? The rig that I was using on 432 was one that you had bought. It was the so-called Echo 70. You had bought it for Jay, K2OVN. He sold it to me, and I was looking for a broader band filter, and I went over to your house to get one. Boy, what comes around goes around. Back to you, Barry.
Okay, I hope I didn't charge you for it, because if I did, I can't have no recollection of it at all. It's totally a blank. Yeah, there is some little correction, I agree with you. Not much, but even in those circumstances, you're good for 500 cycles or better, which is about as much as the guy might be off on the input. And I'll turn it back over to you, because I'm actually faxing stuff at the same time I'm talking. My daughter has me faxing like 20 pages to my son in South Carolina, so I'm like a one-arm paper hanger here. And 2MB.
WBJHWW.
Dick.
Go ahead, Howie.
Yeah, I wonder what the FCC rules would be. That can you do terrestrial repeaters? Would they have to be in the FM subband? I mean, could you do that like on 20 meters, make a full signal sideband repeater? a sideband repeater using linear. Now, what
okay, and a little bit of drop out there, Howie, but I understand what you're saying. On VHF and UHF frequencies, using a medium broadband translator, in other words, you're moving a band of frequencies from, say, the 2-meter band to the 440 band, or from the 440 band to the 1296 band. On VHF frequencies, well, we got a lot of megacycles to play with. For instance, the 432 band, as we call it, really goes from 420 to 450, 30 megacycles wide, one single ham band. Or how about the 10 gigahertz band, 10.0 to 10.5, 500 megacycles wide, at almost exclusive use of ham radio operators. Boy, is their bandwidth up there. So you build a translator, a quasi-broadband translator, no problem. I think it would be nearly impossible to get FCC authorization to do that on the 20-meter band. The 20-meter band is already so darn crowded that if you took the bandwidth of that's capable of encompassing a number of simultaneous signals and you repeat them on that band, I think you're going to create more havoc than benefit. And I guarantee they would not allow it. I think the current rules will not allow it, but even if you ask for a special temporary authority, which is the FCC equivalent of a dispensation, I think they would not issue it. What do you think, Howie?
I agree. I would agree. It would be interesting to try to do it on 10 or 6. It'd just be, you know what, it'd just be a joke to do for an hour or two. Alright, that's nice. But I'll tell you one thing. Dick, you set the 10-meter rate because it's going to be the happening.
You can tell Howie it's been done on 10 meters.
Yeah, 10 meters, I believe it. Because you get a lot of wide open frequencies. But on 20 meters, which is arguably the most crowded band on planet Earth when the band is open, I think you would never get permission to do it there. By the way, the 6-meter band, you're going to hear a lot of people calling it the magic band. The people who love 6 meters love to call it the magic band because almost every kind of propagation in the world exists there. It doesn't matter if you're using single sideband, Morse code, weak signal, WSJT mode, or slow scan video, whatever. That band has got troposcatter, F1, F2, D-layer, E-layer, trans-equatorial. It's got a little bit of everything. Sporadic E, Aurora, Moonbound. What else is there? Meteor scatter. Just about every kind of propagation that mankind has ever existed, with one exception. The guys on 10 gigs frequently use rain scatter. In other words, the individual raindrops are big enough to scatter enough signal on 10 gigs that my buddy, who's up in the Boston area, he's on the far side of Mount Wachusett. So there's a great big 2,500-foot mountain in between us. On 10 gigs, we've made multiple attempts to talk to each other, and nothing got through. A great big rain shower took place in western Massachusetts. He aimed his antenna dead west at the rain cloud. I aimed my antenna on Long Island dead north at the rain cloud, and the reflection of the water drops from the rain cloud gave us communication, and we talked. And so, on 10 gigs, you can do that. That's the one mode of propagation I can think of that 6 meters does not support. It does not support it because the wavelengths are so big compared to the water droplets, you get so little signal reflected, that it's too weak compared to the noise that's on that band. I wouldn't say that the raindrops are not reflecting 10 gigs, you just can't use it. And by the same token, Aurora propagation, you can't use on 10 gigs, you certainly can use it on 6 meters. So, with that one exception, the magic band, 6 meters, covers them all. So if you're a serious VHF-er, how are you telling you to get a 10-meter rig? I'm telling you to get a 6-meter rig. If you got the resources, do both. Get ready for the next sunspot cycle. Anybody want to make any further comments on that one? KQLIW in the tech net.
B2BXO.
Mr. BXO, I should know your name. Start off with your question or comment, sir.
Yes, Frank in Brooklyn. Yeah, the guy who writes the 6-meter comment in QST said
with 6 meters, relatively quiet due to the slip spot minima. He said, go get a 160 meter rig. I'm sure you saw that article.
Yeah, I think you're talking about the World Above 50 megs. And W3ZZ, I think it is, who runs that one. That's an approach. I think we've skipped over Steve, and we shouldn't. KC2, is it MDP? MOV? Steve, I can't read my own writing. I know you've checked in, and I think you've got a question for us. Go right ahead, Steve.
Rob, Dick, good evening to you, good evening to everyone else on the net tonight. I have a question for you, I'll throw it out to the entire net also. I just recently set up a 33 centimeter rig here, and I'm having a less than ideal situation as far as trying to access the local region. I know N2ROW has a series of them, and supposedly a couple out on the island. And basically the only one I can hit is ROW repeated, and supposedly in Suffolk. And that comes in real scratchy. I'll tell you what I'm wanting here. I have a 40-watt rig, a beam antenna, it's got 10 dB gain, SWR flat, LMR 400. The antenna is about, I'd say, about 35 feet up. And, you know, I was just wondering, is it terrain? Is it power? Is it, you know, height? You know, I can't hit anything except this one repeater, and that comes in way noisy. Back to you, Dick.
I can answer that, Dick.
Go ahead, Howie.
Are you running a match track? What are you running up on 10 meters? What are you running on 900 megs?
It's a Kenwood. I think it's TK931.
Oh, I didn't know that Kenwood made it. You're talking about that's, you're talking about 1.2. It's just 900 megs you're talking about. Okay. Let me tell you something about 900 meg. A lot of the repeaters are closed. A lot of the PL aren't. ROW, you've got KQ2H, you got a couple of others. But a lot of these repeaters up there are semi-closed, go ahead.
All right, very good. Yeah, because, you know, I was also looking on the internet, and information is scratchy at best. You go to certain websites, they give you an OPL. You go to other websites, they got one or two repeaters that aren't even in the local area. You go to another one, and some of the information is conflicting. So, yeah, I'm sort of lost here. I'm back here.
That's a 900 meg radio, right? 33 centimeters. You're not talking about 1200, are you?
No, 933.
Kenwood makes a 900 meg radio. I didn't even know that.
Well, it was 800 meg, and the filters were changed to you know, bring it up to center at 915.
Oh, you took a commercial radio. Okay. Honestly, you got to make sure the VCOs are working. Did you put it on a service monitor to see what the sensitivity is?
Oh, no, that I didn't. You know, as a matter of fact, I bought this thing. You know, I bought this thing all set up. You know, I checked it out. I mean, basically, I went through a scanner. You know, I set up a scanner here, you know, basically to see if I could hear myself. And, you know, PL seems to be working. You know, audio sounds good. And like I said, you know, I do believe ROW has a repeater in Suffolk. And that's basically the only one I can hit. And it comes in way scratchy at best. Back to you.
Yeah, I can't tell you, you know, I don't know who did the mod on that radio. I don't know who did the mod, but honestly, you might want to put on a service monitor and check it out. You also want to read the power. Look, anybody can program a radio to go up there, but if you don't change the caps and do all the modifications to these stages and also change the front end circuitry, you may not have the sensitivity, so you need to check the sensitivity, see how close it comes to what the radio did on 800, see if it's close to specs. Over to you, Dick.
Steve, just while I've got my records straight, please give me your full set of call letters phonetically.
Okay, it's Kilowatt Charlie 2, Mike Delta Papa.
Okay, there's my problem. Can't read my own writing. I wrote it down as M-O-T. I do work for the last few years on the 902 to 928 meg band because that's where RFID is most popular these days, radio frequency identification, tags and reading equipment. And there's quite a few shared license-free units being used there, cordless telephone, readers for RFID, as I mentioned. In the past, they were using those frequencies for alarm networks and garage door openers and all kinds of things. So if your receiver had a continuous tune capability, it would be kind of fun to tune across the band and see what you hear. A buddy of mine a year and a half ago was using that band with a tunable receiver, and he did hear quite a few local signals to listen to. With state-of-the-art equipment, where it isn't very difficult these days to get down below 1 decibel of noise figure on the receiver, a Yagi on that band, where the wavelength is 4.9 inches, a Yagi on that band, each of the elements would be approximately 6 inches long. Kent, WA5BJB, Whiskey, Alpha 5, Victor, Juliet, Bravo. If you go to his website, WA5, Victor, Juliet, BJB. If you go to that.com, he has a nice website where he sells these green printed circuit board antennas and 3, 4, 5 elements and so on, probably even beyond. You can easily make yourself a phased array and have a pretty significant antenna, which would have very little weight, very little wind load. You've already got, I think you said, 40 watts of power. Yeah, 40 watts of power. As long as you've got a good receiver noise figure, I think you're going to find that that band has got a little bit more range than 1296 for the same transmit-receive capability. It could be a lot of fun for that band because, for whatever reason, it's not harmonically related, easily harmonically related to the other band. Therefore, it's not overcrowded. It's the wide open spaces where you could be setting up repeaters and remote bases and things like this in that frequency. You've already got a rig there, and I strongly recommend you do what Howie recommended, that is to do check its sensitivity on the right kind of test equipment, just to be sure that that's not a contributing factor. Other than that, you may discover that the closeness of the current repeaters is the reason why you're not hearing much activity. And when we go to those higher bands, 220, 432, 902, 1296, 2.3 gigs, and so on, we've got a conflict of interest. We go there because it's the wide open spaces, but when we go there, we don't want to be alone. We hope there's going to be just enough people that we got somebody to talk to that's interesting to talk to, but not so many that it's a crowded band. So kind of hard to hit that happy medium. Back to you, Steve, for any of the comments. KC2MDP, K2RI getting the tech net. Yep.
Yeah, that's for sure, Dick. Trying to find someone out there. The funny thing is, though, is, you know, some stuff will come in nice and clear, and then all of a sudden it, you know, comes in scratchy. You know, it's just got me confused. You know, I'll just have to trial and error figure it out. Back to you.
HWW.
Yeah, I wonder how much use you've made of 33 centimeters, Howie.
Oh, I've done very little on 33, but I've done a lot of 1200. I think 1200 is a better band. There's just too much crap up on 900 with all the cordless phones and everything. I like 1200 better because it's a lot quieter. And I just, you know, there isn't that much gear available, ham gear available on 900. A lot of, you know, and there's also not that much gear on 1200. But from my experience, Dick, I think 1200 works better as far as the noise for.
Okay, Howie, you probably hear a lot of cordless phones and other things because you're in New York City. And Steve is living in Baldwin, which is not quite as dense. For all we know, his particular community has very few cordless phones and garage door openers and whatever. So the possibility exists that 902 is not so good for you and could be great for him. So he's already bought the equipment. I wouldn't discourage him. Let him get a chance to use it and find out what's going on. If he hasn't been hearing a whole lot of other services, then he's not running into your problem. But he's got to confirm his sensitivity, make sure there isn't something funny going on there. Paul, I wonder if you're around so far tonight. WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet. Okay, Paul is not there. I'm going to give you a couple of words on what I read in the latest issues of Sky and Telescope and Astronomy magazine. The last I remember reading anything official, there was 162 or something like that exoplanets. in other words, 162 planets outside of our solar system had already been discovered. The latest issue of one of those magazines, Sky and Telescope for Arrows, Astronomy, said that the list is now up to 220 exoplanets. They are estimating that one star in three has a planetary system where one of the planets is approximately Earth size and in the so-called Goldilocks zone. Goldilocks zone means it's not too close to the sun, like Pluto, like Mercury, where it boils off all of its water, and it's not so far away like Pluto, where it's continuously living with ice and too cold to do anything. The Goldilocks zone is where you can have liquid water most likely exist. And if one star in three has an Earth-sized approximate planet in the Goldilocks zone, do I have to tell you how much life that potentially represents? That's a mind-blower to me. When Frank Drake did his equation trying to estimate how much life is out there, he made the extremely conservative approach of thinking that only one star in a million had a nice, stable planetary system. Here we're finding out not only do the majority of stars have planetary systems going around them, but one in three, if this estimate is correct, with the latest measurements, is capable of supporting life. One in three has a planet in the right spot, and approximately the right size planet. You combine that with the projects that are now on the drawing board for extremely large telescopes and the OWL, O-W-L, overwhelmingly large telescopes. We're talking about telescopes as big as 100 meters in diameter, Earth-based telescopes. And at first you'd say, gee, how come we didn't do this before? Well, in the past we said, we're not going to make a telescope really big on Earth because it's got to look through the atmosphere, and the atmosphere is always giving you clouds and rain and distortion and whatever, titillation effects. Well, they're getting smarter and smarter when it comes to deformable mirrors that have what's called adaptive optics. So there's ways you can measure what is the distortion of the atmosphere during this millisecond, crank the mirror into the right shape to take out that distortion. All you need is a guide star nearby to the area you're looking at, a star that you use as a reference, and you keep tuning the telescope so that that star gives you the sharpest image, and then you're capable of looking at everything around that star. And even if you don't have a guide star, there's ways they can aim a laser into the sky and look at the reflection of the aerosols in the air and tune for that. So there's all kinds of ways you can take out the atmospheric absorption, atmospheric distortion. So the really big telescopes are on the drawing board. Some of them are already being funded. And so you haven't seen nothing yet. What everybody wants to see is to not just detect the presence of these exoplanets. Right now they've been detecting them by looking at the wobble of the local star. When the Earth and Jupiter goes around our particular sun, the sun gets wobbled by the gravity effect. And if you were standing off 20 light years from here, and you were looking at our particular sun, and you looked at the individual spectral lines it's emitting that represent hydrogen, lithium, helium, oxygen, and so on, you look at those individual spectral lines, and you carefully measure the fact that those lines wobble once per year or once per 10 years, and you figure out how many planets of what size are going around that particular star. That tells you the planet is there. But if you build a big enough telescope and you can look at the planet optically, and then you can resolve whether or not it's got an atmosphere, and what color is it? Does it have water? That's becoming a lot more interesting. Now, the distances between these stars are so darn great that traveling with our technology is out of the question. With their technology, maybe. With our technology, out of the question for at least a few more lifetimes, in my opinion. But communicating by radio, light beams, gamma rays, whatever, cosmic rays, these are all possible. So astronomy is a great thing to get interested in. It's one of the purest sciences there is, from my point of view. However, you can't easily earn a dollar with it. Yeah, if you're running the Hayden Planetarium and your last name is Tyson, you can make a pretty good living, but there's not too many of those guys. Still, as a hobby, it can be an awful lot of fun. Anybody with any further comments or questions, give me a call with us right now before we turn it over to Mel. So bring us up to date on what's going on in Brooklyn. K2RIW listening.
Yeah, and to MB, just a quickie comment on NASA's future plans for the moon and what that has to do with radio amateurs.
Go right ahead. And by the way, I guess it was around 1972-3 when you had Project Moon Ray, which was being run by Nick Marshall, W6OLO, who was then located at Nassau Community College. And he was busily trying to gather a bunch of guys to build a chunk of electronics that was going to be placed on the moon as a repeater by the Apollo astronauts. That was Project Moon Ray. That was roughly 1971-72 time frame. So here we are about to go back to the moon again. And what kind of electronics would you like to put there, Barry? N2, moon bounce. Boy, is there a tie-in there. K2RIW.
Yeah, you could pretty much figure that one out. Yep. Anyway, it appears now that NASA is serious, very serious, about putting a permanent base on the moon. They're doing all kinds of work to those ends. They're looking for water. They're looking to extract water from rocks. They're looking for sources of hydrogen and oxygen on the moon. And they believe they will be able to get some of that. And anyway, that said, because this is going to be a permanent base, and there will be people coming and going, I guess on a 6-month basis or less, that means that probably this time the public wouldn't be against having a package by radio amateurs placed on the moon. Now, there's good and there's bad to that. Obviously, the moon is kind of far away, so the problem is you don't just put a little tiny satellite and, you know, you had it planned to go into orbit and you go ahead and put it on the moon. You can't do that. It's not going to work. The path loss is just too great for that. That's the bad news. But the good news is the moon is a very stable platform, so you could put up solar panels, so you could run more power on the transmitter coming down. Also, because it's a stable platform, you have a place to put a fairly large antenna aimed at Earth, and nobody's going to bother it. It's just going to sit there and look back at the Earth forever, so it could be big, and hopefully it won't deteriorate. There isn't much reason for it to do that, so you could overcome the path loss that way, and now you're going to have to run a hell of a lot of power, maybe 500 watts or something like that, and it would work quite well. I think this is in the offing, and I think as radio amateurs, I personally will be talking to Amstad about that. I think it's time we started looking how to build something. What do you think?
Well, that's definitely within the possibility, Barry. I just did a quick calculation for you. On 432 megacycles, you and I know that when you send a signal to the moon, it reflects off the surface and comes back down to the Earth. That round trip is around 263 decibels. So it takes, in the past, nearly a kilowatt of power, more than 26 dB of antenna gain, and a 1 dB noise figure. You put that all together, and with reasonable probability, you're hearing your echoes off the moon. You're overcoming 263 decibels of path loss round trip. But now, if you put an active chunk of electronics on the moon, you could say you've only got to transmit one way. And one way is 197 dB on Co-32. So, from Earth to moon, one way, 197 dB, which is 66 decibels easier. Power-wise, that is 66 decibels. It's 4 million to 1 power ratio. So power-wise, 1/4 millionth of the power that does moon bounce will allow you to communicate one way between Earth and the moon. Then the electronics on the moon is going to, similar to an amateur radio repeater, give you 60, 80, or whatever decibels of gain on that signal and send it back. And so now a single Yagi with 50 watts or so of power, I think would do it. I'll go through the numbers again sometime, depending on what kind of antenna you got on the moon. A single Yagi, let's say 100 watts of power on the Earth, easily gets access to the Moonray update repeater, 2008 style, 2010 style, and therefore, as long as you can see the moon and your buddy anywhere else on planet Earth can see the moon at the same time, you're communicating. And that can be a lot of fun. Now, that's a kind of satellite that moves very slowly. It rises and sets in 12 hours, whereas almost all the other amateur radio satellites, if it's a low Earth orbit satellite, from horizon to horizon is 18 minutes and it's gone. You've got to continuously be aiming the end up. The higher altitude satellites move a little bit more slowly, but they move. They move. The moon, you could say, almost doesn't move at all. A very simple optical tracker to keep your antenna aimed at the moon, a couple of photocells, so to speak, with some servo motors. And so that would be a fun project. In the past, to try to get the electronics built and qualified, I mean, you don't want a piece of electronics that's going to have a NiCad battery that's going to explode on the Apollo moon lander. So to get a chunk of electronics built and qualified and put it onto the Apollo mission to get it onto the moon during the early 70s, that was an extremely lofty goal. But where we're going to be going back to the moon with a more permanent base to build a chunk of electronics between now and X number of years from now.
This could be done with no batteries at all.
With solar cells is what I think you're about to say. Is that true, Barry?
Yeah, I think you could pull that off, and for the few moments that you don't have solar power, well, you don't have communications, but for the most part you would.
Yeah, if you got a good enough battery supply, the solar cells during the lunar day, which lasts for, 14 days? Yeah. You got 14 days of lunar day and 14 days of lunar night to make a battery supply that during the 14 days gets charged up enough that during the lunar night it plays out that power. That's within the realm of possibility. I would like to have the ability to talk to the moon during new moon. I'll admit that on a perfect new moon, when the moon is directly in front of the sun and you're getting all the solar noise, that's a little bit of a problem. But a day or two before or after that would be kind of fun. How many watts would you like to put on the moon? What mode of transmission would it have, Barry? Sideband for sure. Morse code for sure. Maybe slow scan amateur television. Maybe fast scan amateur television. Maybe facsimile. Some of the Joe Taylor modes. If this was the best of all worlds, what would you like that chunk of electronics on the lunar surface to contain? N2MB, K2RIW.
Okay, I would like to see every mode you said, which would mean a very linear transponder, fairly wide band. That would mean you'd have to have a darn good antenna up there to receive what's going up to it. That's not an impossibility, though. You could make the antenna out of mylar and just sort of, you know, maybe have some kind of sticks or something to hold it out. Things are not heavy on the moon, so that it would keep its shape. And I guess uplink, we would be looking at 500 watts with a fairly small antenna, something like 4 RIW Yagi, something like that, or a 10-foot dish or something on 432. Not a big antenna. Downlink, I think we'd need something like a 20 or 25-foot parabolic dish up there. I think uplink should be on 1296 or 2304. And downlink should be on perhaps 2304. And I don't even think 2 meters is a good band for that. Perhaps 432. Over.
The nice thing about the moon is that the exact same face always aims toward the Earth. If you are standing on the moon and you look at the Earth in right ascension or left-right, what you call it, east-west, the Earth almost does not move at all east-west for a person standing on the moon. The Earth does move something like plus or minus 9 degrees north-south. So if you can make an antenna pattern that is approximately 1.5 degrees wide in azimuth, approximately 18 degrees wide in elevation, that antenna could easily be made out of a series of Yagis. And the reason I like the idea of Yagis is because it's much lighter. Yagis on the frequencies you're talking about, 900 megs, 1296, 2304, they're not popular antennas on the Earth. Loop Yagis, sort of, but regular Yagis are not popular because droplets of water on the ends of the elements early in the morning when you got great big drops of dew will drastically detune the antenna. The moon doesn't have that problem. So an array of Yagis that pops out for each of the bands of interest is not very difficult. And you could set up an awful lot of area of antenna with a whole lot of gain as long as it meets that plus or minus 1.5 degrees, the 1.5 degrees of total azimuth and 18 degrees of total elevation. It would be a fan beam, so to speak. A vertical beaver tail would be the beam shape. You'd lock it down. It wouldn't have to track the Earth. Well, you could put a tracker if you wanted to get a little bit more gain, but I'd rather keep it simple. You lock it down. There's no lunar wind. The Earth is always in the same position, so to speak, with this little bit of motion that I just talked about. And now, once you've got that amount of antenna gain, I think we're talking here about 20, 25 dB of antenna gain, the electronics start becoming an awful lot more simple. A good 1 dB noise figure receiver over that band, I think only a few watts into a single Yagi on a chimney down here would talk to it. What do you think, Barry?
I had to give that a little thought. I think not. I think uplink you'd have to have, I'm trying to give this what is the pass loss going up about 100 and something dB? Was it 160 round trip on 2 meters? So what are we talking about on 432, for instance?
432 round trip moon bounce is 263 dB.
That's figuring a 9% reflector, though, right?
That's the real measured number that people have done, and I think it's 7% moon reflection. But now, one way to the moon is 197 dB, which is 66 decibels easier, 4 million to 1 power-wise easier to get the uplink. I think, if I do the calculation, I think I'm going to find out that a single Yagi, 10 watts or so of power, maybe 100 watts of power, on Earth, aimed at the moon, is going to talk to your moon-bound antenna, to your antenna on the lunar surface. Because as long as you fulfill the requirements I just mentioned in degrees of beamwidth, I think you've got 20-some-odd decibels of gain on both reception and transmission on that electronics that's on the moon. That makes life a lot easier. Back to you, Barry.
Yeah, because there's a couple of really nice things here. One of them is you could change your antenna. If you're going to have crews of people going...